Chapter 22. Written in the same hand as all the other memoranda relating to the political prisoners of that year. But it is a lie, she exclaimed. He was never admitted to the prisons. Are you sure? How should he have been? He might have gone as his father's assistant. But if he had seen my poor brother, he would have told me long ago. Not if he had really given up this letter, I retorted. I supposed her quick intelligence had seized this from the first, but I saw now that it came to her as a shock. She stood motionless, clenching the letter in her hands, and I could guess the rapid travel of her thoughts. Suddenly she came up to me. See, Colonel Lingdon, she said, you have been a good friend of mine, though I think you have not liked me lately. But whether you like me or not, I know you will not deceive me. On your honor, do you think this memorandum may have been written later than the letter? I hesitated. If S.E. had cried out once against Brig, I should have wished myself out of the business, but she was too sure of him. On my honor, I said, I think it hardly possible. The ink has faded to the same degree. She made a rapid comparison, and folded the letter with a gesture of assent. It may have been written by an enemy, I went on, wishing to clear myself of any appearance of malice. She shook her head. H.E. was barely 15, and his father was on the side of the government. Besides, this would have served him with the government, and the liberals would never have known of it. This was unanswerable, and still not a word of revolt against the man whose condemnation she was pronouncing. Then, I said with a vague gesture. She caught me up. T. Then, you have answered my objections, I returned. Your objections? To thinking that Signor Briga could have begun his career as a patriot by betraying a friend. I had brought her to the test at last, but my eyes shrank from her face as I spoke. There was a dead silence, which I broke by adding lamely, colon, but no doubt Signor Briga could explain. She lifted her head, and I saw that my triumph was to be short. She stood erect, a few paces from me, resting her hand on a table, but not for support. Of course he can explain, she said. Do you suppose I ever doubted it? But she paused a moment, fronting me nobly. He need not, for I understand it all now. Ah, I murmured with a last flicker of irony. I understand, she repeated. It was she, now, who sought my eyes and held them. It is quite simple, he could not have done otherwise. This was a little too oracular to be received with equanimity. I suppose I smiled. He could not have done otherwise, she repeated with tranquil emphasis. H.E. merely did what is every Italian's duty, he put Italy before himself and his friends. She waited a moment, and then went on with growing passion, colon, surely you must see what I mean? He was evidently in the prison with his father at the time of my poor brother's death. Emilio perhaps guessed that he was a friend or perhaps appealed to him, because he was young and looked kind. But don't you see how dangerous it would have been for Briga to bring this letter to us, or even to hide it in his father's house? It is true that he was not yet suspected of liberalism, but he was already connected with Young Italy, and it is just because he managed to keep himself so free of suspicion that he was able to do such good work for the cause. She paused, and then went on with a firmer voice. Why, you don't know the danger we all lived in. The government spies were everywhere. The laws were set aside as the Duke pleased. Was not Emilio hanged for having an ode to Italy in his desk? After Menotti's conspiracy, the Duke grew mad with fear. He was haunted by the dread of assassination. The police, to prove their zeal, had to trump up false charges and arrest innocent persons. You remember the case of poor Ricci? Incriminating papers were smuggled into people's houses. They were condemned to death on the paid evidence of brigands and galley slaves. The families of the revolutionists were under the closest observation, and were shunned by all who wished to stand well with the government. If Briga had been seen going into our house, he would at once have been suspected. If he had hidden Emilio's letter at home, its discovery might have ruined his family as well as himself. It was his duty to consider all these things. In those days, no man could serve two masters, and he had to choose between endangering the cause and failing to serve a friend. He chose the latter, and he was right. I stood listening, fascinated by the rapidity and skill with which S.E. had built up the hypothesis of Briga's defense. But before she ended, a strange thing happened. Her argument had convinced me. It seemed to me quite likely that Briga had in fact been actuated by the motives she suggested. I suppose she read the admission in my face, for hers lit up victoriously. "You see," she exclaimed. "Ah, it takes one brave man to understand another." Perhaps I winced a little at being thus coupled with her hero. At any rate, some last impulse of resistance made me say I should be quite convinced, if Briga had only spoken of the letter afterward. If brave people understand each other, I cannot see why he should have been afraid of telling you the truth. She colored deeply, and perhaps not quite resentfully. "You are right," she said. "He need not have been afraid. But he does not know me as I know him. I was useful to Italy, and he may have feared to risk my friendship." "You are the most generous woman I ever knew," I exclaimed. She looked at me intently. "Why, you also are generous," she said. I stiffened instantly, suspecting a purpose behind her praise. I have given you small proof of it," I said. She seemed surprised. "I in bringing me this letter? What else could you do?" She sighed deeply. "You can give me proof enough now." As he had dropped into a chair, and I saw that we had reached the most difficult point in our interview. "Captain Lingdon," she said, "does anyone else know of this letter?" "No. I was alone in the archives when I found it."
"And you spoke of it to no one?"
"To no one. Then no one must know." I bowed. "It is for you to decide." She paused. "And not even my mother," she continued, with a painful blush. I looked at her in amazement. "And not even," she shook her head sadly. "Why, you think me a cruel daughter? Well, he was a cruel friend. What he did was done for Italy. Shall I allow myself to be surpassed?" I felt a pang of commiseration for the mother. "Be, but you will at least tell the Countess," her eyes filled with tears. "And my poor mother, don't make it more difficult for me." "But I don't understand. Don't you see that she might find it impossible to forgive him? She has suffered so much. And I can't risk that, for in her anger she might speak. And even if she forgave him, she might be tempted to show the letter. Don't you see that, even now, a word of this might ruin him? I will trust his fate to no one. If Italy needed him, then she needs him far more today." She stood before me magnificently, in the splendor of her great refusal. Then she turned to the writing table at which S.E. had been seated when I came in. Her ceiling taper was still alight, and she held her brother's letter to the flame. I watched her in silence while it burned, but one more question rose to my lips. "You will tell him, then, what you have done for him," I cried. And at that the heroine-turned-woman melted and pressed unhappy hands in mine. "Don't you see that I can never tell him what I do for him? That is my gift to Italy," she said. The dilettante. It was on an impulse hardly needing the arguments he found himself advancing in its favor that Thursdale, on his way to the club, turned as usual into Mrs. Vervain's street. The "as usual" was his own qualification of the act, a convenient way of bridging the interval in days and other sequences that lay between this visit and the last. It was characteristic of him that he instinctively excluded his call 2 days earlier with Ruth Gaynor from the list of his visits to Mrs. Vervain. The special conditions attending it had made it no more like a visit to Mrs. Vervain than an engraved dinner invitation is like a personal letter. Yet it was to talk over his call with Miss Gaynor that he was now returning to the scene of that episode, and it was because Mrs. Vervain could be trusted to handle the talking over as skillfully as the interview itself that, at her corner, he had felt the dilettante's irresistible craving to
to take a last look at a work of art that was passing out of his possession. On the whole, he knew no one better fitted to deal with the unexpected than Mrs. Vervain. She excelled in the rare art of taking things for granted, and Thursdale felt a pardonable pride in the thought that she owed her excellence to his training. Early in his career, Thursdale had made the mistake, at the outset of his acquaintance with a lady, of telling her that he loved her, and exacting the same avowal in return. The latter part of that episode had been like a long walk back from a picnic, when one has to carry all the crockery one has finished using. It was the last time Thursdale ever allowed himself to be encumbered with the debris of a feast. He thus incidentally learned that the privilege of loving her is one of the least favors that a charming woman can accord, and in seeking to avoid the pitfalls of sentiment he had developed a science of evasion in which the woman of the moment became a mere implement of the game. He owed a great deal of delicate enjoyment to the cultivation of this art. The perils from which it had been his refuge became naively harmless. Was it possible that he who now took his easy way along the levels had once preferred to gasp on the raw heights of emotion? Youth is a high-colored season, but he had the satisfaction of feeling that he had entered earlier than most into that chiaroscuro of sensation, where every half-tone has its value. As a promoter of this pleasure, no one he had known was comparable to Mrs. Vervain. He had taught a good many women not to betray their feelings, but he had never before had such fine material to work in. As he had been surprisingly crude when he first knew her, capable of making the most awkward inferences, of plunging through thin ice, of recklessly undressing her emotions. But as he had acquired, under the discipline of his reticences and evasions, a skill almost equal to his own, and perhaps more remarkable in that it involved keeping time with any tune he played, and reading at sight some uncommonly difficult passages. It had taken Thursdale 7 years to form this fine talent, but the result justified the effort. At the crucial moment, as he had been perfect, her way of greeting Miss Gaynor had made him regret that he had announced his engagement by letter. It was an evasion that confessed a difficulty, a deviation implying an obstacle, where, by common consent, it was agreed to see none. It betrayed, in short, a lack of confidence in the completeness of his method. It had been his pride never to put himself in a position which had to be quitted, as it were, by the back door. But here, as he perceived, the main portals would have opened for him of their own accord. All this, and much more, he read in the finished naturalness with which Mrs. Vervain had met Miss Gaynor. He had never seen a better piece of work. There was no over-eagerness, no suspicious warmth, above all, and this gave her art the grace of a natural quality. There were none of those damnable implications whereby a woman, in welcoming her friend's betrothed, may keep him on pins and needles while she laps the lady in complacency. So masterly a performance, indeed, hardly needed the offset of Miss Gaynor's doorstep words, "Oh, be so kind to me, how she must have liked you." Though he caught himself wishing it lay within the bounds of fitness to transmit them, as a final tribute, to the one woman he knew who was unfailingly certain to enjoy a good thing. It was perhaps the one drawback to his new situation, that it might develop good things which it would be impossible to hand on to Margaret Vervain. The fact that he had made the mistake of underrating his friend's powers, the consciousness that his writing must have betrayed his distrust of her efficiency, seemed an added reason for turning down her street instead of going on to the club. He would show her that he knew how to value her. He would ask her to achieve with him a feat infinitely rarer and more delicate than the one he had appeared to avoid. Incidentally, he would also dispose of the interval of time before dinner. Ever since he had seen Miss Gaynor off, an hour earlier, on her return journey to Buffalo, he had been wondering how he should put in the rest of the afternoon. It was absurd how he missed the girl. Yes, that was it. The desire to talk about her was, after all, at the bottom of his impulse to call on Mrs. Vervain. It was absurd, if you like, but but it was delightfully rejuvenating. He could recall the time when he had been afraid of being obvious. Now he felt that this return to the primitive emotions might be as restorative as a holiday in the Canadian woods. And it was precisely by the girl's candor, her directness, her lack of complications, that he was taken. The sense that she might say something rash at any moment was positively exhilarating. If S.E. had thrown her arms about him at the station, he would not have given a thought to his crumpled dignity. It surprised Thursdale to find what freshness of heart he brought to the adventure, and though his sense of irony prevented his ascribing his intactness to any conscious purpose, he could but rejoice in the fact that his sentimental Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.